This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Master Assassins by Robert V.S. Reddick. Narrated by Eric Michael Summerer. Down the fanatic, down the clown, down, down, hammer them down. Yeats. 1. Eternity Camp. Here is the door you have been seeking. Behind it, the promised flood. Khosraji incantation. By the third day, the rumor can no longer be contained. It is whispered in the black tents, shared like smokes among the men on patrol, murmured in the drill yard before the bellowed morning prayer. It is weird and horrific, and yet a curse no one can fail to understand. Someone's mind has been stolen, and the thief still walks the camp. The signs are innumerable. The master of horses finds two stallions lamed overnight. An armory clerk displays a broadsword twisted into a spiral like a blade of grass. A cook discovers worms thick as men's fingers writhing in the belly of a well-roasted boar. And the prophet's eldest son has a toothache. These calamities, and others shared over dawn biscuits or evening rubbish fires or blazing midday marches, point to a single conclusion. The camp is under attack, and the assailant can only be a yatra, a spirit thief, which, as everyone knows, can work dark magic from within its victim's pilfered soul. Khandri Hingeman, distinguished corporal, smiles at this talk of possession, but the frowns of his fellow soldiers bring him quickly to his senses. The prophet's firstborn. Nothing touching that family is a matter for mirth. The son's toothache, moreover, has struck just hours after he announced the date of the spring offensive. And isn't the boar his gift to the soldiers, in honor of the victories ahead? Khandri tries to drop the matter. Sorcery isn't high on his list of preoccupations. They're at war. But to his surprise, the hostile looks only multiply, as though he has crossed some threshold of recklessness. Finally, one evening after final prayers, a sergeant beckons him near.
It's not you, he whispers. It's that half-brother of yours.
Mektu, sir? Khandri jumps, startling the man. What the hell has he done now?
Talk, that's what, says the sergeant. He won't shut up about the yatra, and he's got the men scared to death. It's the way he tells the stories. It's the look on his face.
Khandri understands the sergeant all too well, and that night he barely sleeps. In the morning, anxious and miserable, he prowls the camp until he locates his brother.
You jackass, he says. You'll get us killed talking like that.
They are behind a recreation tent on the camp's southern perimeter. The air reeks of cane liquor and unwashed men. An impenetrable wall of fishhook tree branches cuts off the view of the drylands beyond. It is very early. Khandri hears the flat, tireless tolling of goat bells as a herd flows around a corner of the thorn wall, and a child's laugh, and the rising chord of the fiddler trees, aerial roots rasping one on another, singing home the little brown bats that roost in their arms.
Us? Says Mektu. Of course us, Khandri snaps. The prophet knows who our father is. She knows everything about the old man.
Mektu raises an eyebrow as if to say, not everything. Khandri shakes his head.
What a pig you are, he says. I hope they send you off to fight ghouls in the marshes. I do a dance, I swear.
Mektu shakes his head.
You'd miss me. Everyone needs someone they can trust.
Khandri can't quite keep the smile off his face. Mektu laughs aloud, throws an arm over his shoulder, kisses his forehead. Khandri is laughing too, but perhaps he tenses at his brother's touch, for Mektu abruptly releases him and steps back.
You don't believe me.
He is a lean soldier, with a spine that is never quite straight. His laugh has something of a horse's whinny. His eyes meander like gnats. Khandri is shorter, but more sound. He has bested Mektu often at wrestling and battle dance, which are juried sports in the Army of Revelation. But he has also seen his half-brother drunk and brawling, and hopes never to fight him in earnest.
How do you know it's a Yatra? Condry demands.
Bad things happen all the time.
That's the proof, says Mektu. Each day's worse than the one before. Batali thinks it was called out of the desert by a witch.
Batali's a fool. And high before breakfast. Last week he said he was engaged to a goat.
Mektu's face darkens.
It's here, brother, he says.
Then whose mind has it taken?
No one knows. No one ever knows.
What if I told you I did? Condry turns him a wry smile, but the look fades quickly into one of alarm.
You don't really, he murmurs.
Do you? Among the worst powers ascribed to a Yatra is the ability to sense when it has been detected. To look out through stolen eyes, read the faces around it, and know who has guessed the truth. Such persons are doomed. The Yatra will not rest until it kills them.
Mektu snaps a branch from the fishhook tree fence. He draws his thumb over a long, savage thorn.
You've never faced one, he says.
Condry bites his lips. He's heard the stories, from the time before he came to live with Mektu and the rest of the family. Absurd stories, conflicting, intractable as weeds. How a Yatra assaulted their little brother, the youngest, who still sleeps with a knife in his hand. Or was the target that spinster aunt, who set the orphanage on fire? Or their father, who rises, dresses, unlocks gates, walks for miles in his sleep? Or Mektu himself?
There's never any proof, Condry hears himself say. I don't believe the damned things exist.
4 cases last year.
Condry chuckles. 4 rumored Yatras in the world's greatest army. All of them elsewhere, naturally. In some mountain division or wilderness fort, never here in Eternity Camp, where the question might be settled. But perhaps this time it will be settled. The eldest son has a toothache, after all.
Then he sees the flash of red on Mektu's finger, bright in the morning sun.
Never laugh at them, says his half-brother. They can't stand it when you laugh.
Many nights thereafter, in the wastes and hovels and palaces of Uroth, Condry will lie brooding on the power of shame. What did he unleash by laughing at Mektu then? If he had summoned more patience, if he had listened to his half-brother's ravings a bit more generously, if he had simply kept his silence, everything might have been different. Even the murders, even that catastrophic night. His feet might have carried him elsewhere. He might never have glimpsed the crooked shack or heard the cries from within. He and Mektu might still be as they once were, unnoticed, invisible, far less than a footnote to this war. Imagine that, he will think, to be ordinary, to be something the world overlooks. No one's obsession, no one's idea of evil incarnate, blood traitors, spears hurled with cold precision at the gods.
That evening the brothers meet again. Condry is in their unit's dinner line, which snakes out of the mess tent and into the yard. The area is crowded with fighting men seated on stumps and makeshift benches, eating from tin plates and calabashes, waving away flies. Boys from the village hover about the edges of the yard, laughing and horsing around, waiting for the peels and bones and gristle their mothers will transform into soup. Mektu steps from the tent and approaches him, wearing an odd little smile.
Bugger off, he says.
Condry scowls.
What the hell is your problem? You walked up to me.
Mektu shakes his head.
They're going to throw us at the Galsunay again. Just us, the 8th Legion, against the same pricks who cut us to ribbons 2 years ago. I meant Kro'Kira. Bug over, bugger out. You're with me, aren't you?
His brother is still smiling. Condry feels his blood run cold. He turns away, furiously composed, and walks straight out of the yard.
Mektu is speaking of desertion, of bugging out.
He has garbled the phrase in Khosraji, the world's dying common tongue, but then helpfully repeated himself in the language of their clan, which nearly everyone in the army speaks.
It is the act of a lunatic. Only your love, children, can light the way to heaven's path, the prophet teaches. Without that flame we are lost, all of us, and the world shall wither like a seedling in a cave. Love is compulsory. Even a dispirited sigh can mean punishment. Desertion means death by torture, live coals in the eye sockets, shards of glass down the throat. Condry smokes for an hour behind his legion's stables, hiding from Mektu, squatting low on his heels. Dinner is over. He won't get a crumb before breakfast, and tonight he will have to avoid the drinking areas. His brother will appear in one of them to play his allotted role in the camp, somewhere between daring eccentric and despised clown. It has always been the same with Mektu. The amusing stories, the elaborate jokes, the poetry committed to memory, lofty or obscene, the brilliant vocal impressions. Condry's brother can draw an audience just by opening his mouth. But only a fool seeks attention in Eternity Camp. Before the Yatra panic began, there was talk of a new and horrific loyalty test, conceived by the prophet's seers in the bowels of the Palace of Radiance, a means of distinguishing between the faithful and the false. Does such a test truly exist? And if it does, how would each of them fare? I might pass, Condry thinks. I might get that lucky. He would not. For Mektu has a gift for saying the wrong thing. You can take him to a birthday party and count the minutes until he makes a child cry. At weddings, he is apt to mention the last woman the groom has slept with. You're a lucky girl, Chelly. Just ask Sukina. Condry once dragged him to the hospital to visit their dying grandmother. Mektu lectured her about the dangers of sunstroke and propositioned the nurse. You could only shake your head and find a way to protect yourself, of course, to help your brother without wearing him like a chain. They are not close, Condry reminds himself. They call each other brother, dropping the half, and burn sage for their ancestors, and swap shirts on New Year's morning like all brothers in the Chiloto clan. Yet what do such courtesies change? Blood means nothing, finally, and a man who pokes tigers with a stick will one day be mauled. You can take the stick away, but he'll find another. Last week the prophet's youngest son, a boy barely into his teens, stabbed the village tailor and set fire to his shop. The old man had mended his vest with the wrong color thread. Sticks are everywhere. You have to walk about with closed fists, or they will jump into your hands. But can it possibly be true? Another assault on the Galsune? Condry nurses his cheroot down to a lip-scorching bud. He thinks. Chindalin. That's a question for Chindalin. The Master Smith knows more about what is going on in the sprawling camp than anyone. He is no gossip. It is merely that the officers confide in him while he repairs their sabers, their bejeweled daggers and kamas and mataglins, all those distinguishing blades. They like him, those officers. He asks no favors, drops no hints about the lightness of his purse. He simply works and listens to their chatter, and no one ever learns what he overhears. No one save the brothers, that is. Condry leaves his hiding place, wades back into the evening throng. Great rows of tents and barracks, some a mile long or more, channel the men into surging lines. In the twilight, cheers and laughter, empty bottles, ribald songs. Priests in plum-colored robes move among the soldiers, lofting shepherd's sticks. From each stick dangles a paper lamp, and within each of these fragile spheres dances an uncanny flame. Some mixture of oils that shimmer from green to blue to yellow and moan like the wind in a cave. Ghost lamps, calling to the ancestral dead, seeking their aid against the Yatra. Condry squeezes north through the crowd in the direction of the weapons shop. Eternity Camp is a ramshackle city, a glued-together mass of shabby wards pertaining to the many branches of the Army of Revelation. At its center squats the Palace of Radiance, a hulking complex built on the spot where the last Vajek governor was hanged, ending 6 centuries of occupation and massacres for the Chiloto people. Around the palace walls, 30,000 soldiers make their homes under canvas or tin. Another 40,000 are dispersed among the various fronts. Recently, the most savage fighting has been in the north. The Prophet has taken land from the Vajeks there. She will take everything from the Vajeks one day. The brothers made the march into Vajan land during their second deployment, perhaps because they had some slight medical training, or perhaps because Chindalin had called in a favor. They were sent into the frontline carnage less often than many. Long weeks of guilt and nausea lard Condry's memories of that campaign. Prayers for the men he dragged back from the lines, prying their hands from arrows before they ripped them out and bled to death. Stuffing viscera back into bellies, trying to distinguish burned clothes from skin. They were resented. In that medical rear guard, survival was more likely than not. A year later, when they fought the Galsune, there was no rear guard, and no true front, for that matter. Only doomed incursions into dry wooded hills, blundering and panic, slaughter from every side. He shakes his head. There are memories and memories, the prophet teaches. One sort is a chalice of fire and a sacrament, the other a cup of poison, drawn from black swamps of despair. He will not drink from the swamp. After all, it is a night of comforts, the first of three comprising the Feast of the Boar. The holiday is a great favorite, the army's only bacchanal. It ends on the solemn Day of Revelation, which marks the prophet's first encounter with the gods and the start of her journey on heaven's path. The mob thins swiftly, north of the palace. Condry shivers. The day's warmth is gone. The sun has set behind the coastal range. In the east, stars blaze already, untwinkling as always over the desert, the fierce, famished spider eyes of heaven. He thinks, my brother's deluded. The prophet won't make us fight the Galsune alone. We're her children. She says so. Why would she send us to our deaths? Men with torches by the east gate, surrounding a pair of wrestlers, cheering them on. Outside, on the village road, a few early prostitutes in skin-tight wraps. Touch me. Touch me. Use those soft little hands. A low voice, slippery as oil soap. Condry frowns. He knows the voice. It belongs to Skem, the wax man. There they are in the shadow of the hospital, the pusher and his unlucky whore. Condry almost shouts an insult. He loathes Skem. Quite a few men do. He has seen the effects of wax, a drug applied warm to the skin, a drug that holds off hunger and fear but makes animals of addicts, a drug that corrodes the soul. But why confront Skem? What good can it do? The camp has a dozen wax dealers, and they thrive on abuse. Condry walks on, suddenly breathless. Muffled cries from behind him. Tang of antiseptic on the breeze. He stops. Bemused, he looks down at his feet. Damned if he should be stopping. No good will come of it. Don't look back there. Just don't. He looks back. There are three people, not two, by the hospital wall. The one he took for the prostitute is in fact a man, standing beside Skem and helping him restrain a much smaller figure. A child. Condry spits out a curse and starts toward them, noisily, making his intentions plain. The men turn. Condry catches a whiff of the clove oil Skem combs into his beard. He does not know the second man, a pale, enormously muscled soldier with a bottle tucked under his arm. But the man knows him, apparently.
It's Crazy Mektu's brother, he says.
No insults, says Skem. We're all brothers here. You need a fix, Hingeman? Normally you'd have to tell me by third rotation, but you're in luck. I have plenty. Wait around the corner till we're finished.
I'm not a waxer, says Condry.
Then fuck off, suggests the larger man.
They are holding a village boy. Gag in his mouth, pants around his ankles. The boy's white eyes turn to Condry, pleading. Skem's fingers are tight around his neck.
You can have a turn when we're finished, he says, but I'll need a few gams from you, Condry. Only fair.
Condry feels his throat constrict. He is not a brawler, either. In fact, he hates to fight. The very prospect afflicts him with a clammy sorrow like the onset of disease. He unbuckles his machete. It hangs there, loose on his belt. He looks the big soldier in the eye. "You just step away," he says. With a lazy motion, Skem pulls the boy against his side. Fitted over his knuckles is a thrusting dagger, 5 or 6 inches long. He rests the flat of the blade on the boy's cheek. Then he glances at Condry, and his look is oddly coy.
"Do you know what I think?" he says. "I think you're a bit sentimental, Hingeman. Maybe you had a sheltered childhood, or a baby brother you were fond of. That's all right. In fact, it's sort of endearing."
"In a bitch," says the pale soldier.
"But little Faru here," Skem continues, "is nothing to any of us. A gnat, or in the words of our prophet, one leaf in a forest aflame. What's more, you don't fuck with me. Everyone knows that. Because if you do, if you fuck with the Waxman, someone calls on you in the night."
Condry stands very still. This rumor, too, has reached his ears, that Skem employs some kind of enforcer. An assassin, that is. A man who waits in darkness, cuts throats from behind, vanishes without bloodying his hands. The big man drains his bottle ostentatiously. Reversing his grip, he swings it hard against the hospital wall. The bottle shatters. The man proffers its jagged neck.
"In a hurry to bleed, Hingeman?"
Condry shakes his head.
"I don't want to fight at all."
"Who does?" says Skem brightly. "Waste of a nice fucking evening."
He taps the dagger against the boy's cheek, then bends to kiss the small round forehead.
"You'd like to get this over with, wouldn't you? Tell him, boy. Go ahead."
The child's bare legs are shaking. His eyes lock on Condry's own.
"You can't save them all, Hingeman," says Skem brightly. "Now, if you'll kindly..."
The boy's head jerks. His teeth close on Skem's hand below the dagger, and despite the gag in his mouth, he draws blood. At the same instant, Condry moves, striking Skem's face dead on with all his strength. 3 blows, half a second. Skem drops like a sack, and as he does so, Condry whirls to face the larger man. The soldier hesitates. Condry does not. Right elbow to jaw, left arm swipe, bottle blocked, right fist, left knee, down. Condry kicks the bottle away, battling the urge to be sick. He hates fighting, but he is very good at it. He has killed 6 times in his 3 years in the army, but managed to finish his last deployment without killing anyone. He wants to believe he can finish his life. Skem is wheezing, spitting blood. He claws at the boy, whose teeth are still locked on his hand. Condry puts his boot on Skem's neck. Bending, he takes a firm grip on the dagger.
"Polajek," he says to the boy. "It's all right. Let go."
At first, the boy is uncomprehending, or perhaps unable to respond. Then his mouth opens and he flings himself away and is gone instantly in the darkness, a fish thrown to the sea. The big soldier lies curled in a ball. Skem cradles his hand, eyes bulging, mouth agape. Twisting his neck, he looks up in horror at Condry.
"Yatra,"
he says. Last week, Skem had held forth from his bunk. How he paid whores only in wax. How he'd massaged the drug into their scalps as he took them from behind. How days later they'd crawl back to him on their knees, give him anything, their bodies and gold besides.
"And who are you to judge me?" he demanded, although no one said a word. "I'm the same as anyone. I get pleasure where I can."
"From women too hungry or frightened to escape you. From girls so worn out from hauling water or firewood they fall asleep by the brothel door. From boys like that Faru, fleeing with the gag still in his mouth." Condry's hands are shaking. he touches the machete he never bothered to draw. Men will sleep with village women, or foreign women from the war zones, or any women they can buy with scrip or coin or half a cabbage. Those with money even go with the Castrella courtesans, who ride in like dreams on their slate-gray stallions, galloping along the perimeter fence, swords aloft, twisting in the saddles to reveal a dark thigh, a naked midriff, taunting the men with their unbearably suggestive songs. Lust is currency. Lust is a common tongue. Condry himself has spent money on women. You can't refuse without declaring yourself a luli. But he cannot fuck them. The moment he is alone in their brothel chambers, their squalid huts, their tents half a mile from the killing fields, the moment they light a candle and he sees their gaunt cheekbones, their fingers cracked from years at the washtub, the moment their thin flanks and worried nipples emerge from threadbare clothes, his desire makes a blushing exit. His lust vanishes like a breath of song. He is not indifferent. He wants to be there, to sit and rock these women in his arms, but to take from them. To take the least thing, a sigh, a shadow, the stroke of a hand. No, that is unthinkable. He pays what they ask for, endures their bafflement, hopes they will not talk. Later he boasts with his comrades. That girl Anuli with the melon ass? Oh, brother, she has fire down there. And that tongue? I shouldn't be talking. Forget I spoke, will you? Leave her to me. He has not touched a woman since he joined the army. It is his secret agony, his private shame. But a child. He could have killed Skem tonight with one swing of his machete. A braver man would have done so. The weapon shop is always brightly lit. There is the yellow glow of oil lamps, dangling on chains from the roof beams, and there is the furnace, smoldering like the throat of a dragon. The broad front doors stand open, letting a little of the dragon's breath escape. Condry pauses at the threshold. He does not wish to blunder in on an officer. Tonight, however, he sees no one, not even Chindelin. Only the small desert bats come and go, improbable acrobats, feasting on the insects drawn to the light. He steps within. The heat of the fire welcome, the night already cold. He whistles for Chindelin. They are friendly enough for whistles, though the older man will pretend to be annoyed, but no answer comes. Arranged near the furnace are the anvil, stacks of raw iron, cooling tubs, and a rough table on which Chindelin lays out his tools. Condry moves carefully between these objects. Where can the smith have gone? The furnace is roaring. In its mouth, a length of iron glows red upon the coals. Then Condry sees the knife. It lies on a clean blue cloth at the center of the table. He knows it at once for a mataglin, one of the huge desert knives of the Parthian nomads. It is almost as long as a machete, and it broadens near the tip, where three vicious teeth curve out like bending flames. A weapon made for beheading, disemboweling, for killing with a single blow. This mataglin, however, was clearly made for a prince or sartaf, or some other ruler of men. The steel blade is inlaid with gold in a beautiful swirling script that races from the pommel to the teeth. The pommel itself is a smooth, cream-colored wood bound with rings of gold. Small rubies, like droplets of blood, encircle the handguard, and at the base is a pale blue stone the size of a quail's egg. Under the lamps, the stone gleams like enchanted ice. Condry's heart is pounding. He has never been alone with such wealth. How can it be lying here? Why is it not under guard? He glances left and right, and starts to turn away. But the blade is fascinating, and he will never again see such a thing. Not once, not ever. He reaches out to touch the stone. Little bastard, get your filthy paws away! Condry nearly leaps out of his skin. The smith is seated at the far end of the building, copper jug in hand, broad buttocks tipping back on a stool.
Uncle! I was just
trying to get your head snipped off. That knife belongs to the Enlightened One.
Condry shivers. Of course it does. Who but the Prophet could possibly afford such a treasure?
Chindelin rolls to his feet and saunters near. He takes a towel from around his enormously powerful shoulders and mops his face. He is Molonji by birth. His family comes from the great cattle-herding lands of the south, but he has spent so many years among the Chilotos that only his bulk and pure chocolate blackness hint at his origins. A leather apron covers his torso like a suit of mail. His jeweler's glasses are high on his forehead. There is no smell of liquor on him. He drinks only water, gallons of water, when he works.
She left you alone with this knife. The Prophet trusts you, uncle.
Chindelin scowls at him, cockeyed.
Stop calling me uncle. I'm not that old.
Condry smiles. He will always be uncle. In point of fact, they are not blood relations, but the bond between Chindelin and his family is absolute. The smith is his father's best friend, and godfather to all six of the old man's children. Before joining the army, he had eaten at their table three or four nights a week.
I don't know why they left me alone, he says. For a while, the men who brought it were standing around like goons. They wanted it sharpened, nothing else, and I was nearly finished when their commander showed up and took them away. He said a new team would be along any minute to collect the knife, but I've been waiting over an hour. I wish they'd fucking arrive.
Is it old?
Old? Is the ocean large? Is the desert hot at noontime? That's a Kijinthu blade from before the Empire of the Khosraj. It's ancient. Why are you here?
Can I touch it?
No, imbecile. Keep your goddamn distance. Step over there by the door.
It's cold.
So is a spear through your belly button. Why are you here, Condry?
I want to know about the spring offensive, uncle.
Chindelin glares at him again. He is, in fact, old enough. He pulls off his jeweler's glasses and slides them into his pocket.
You look starved. Like a rat.
I'm all right, says Condry.
Chindelin sighs and walks to the table. He lifts a small wooden box and brings it back to where Condry hovers by the door. He lifts the lid. Inside are sausages, glistening with oil, lined up like cigars. Condry's head swims. He has not tasted sausage in years.
Take one. No, take two, but eat them both right now.
They're fresh, aren't they? Who the hell gave them to you?
Ojulon.
Condry's hand snaps back as if from a live coal. Ojulon is the Prophet's third son, also a gleeful killer, a maniac. Unlike his elder brothers, he has no military rank and takes little interest in the War of Revelation. He is mercurial. He can be found drinking with the troops at sunset and whipping their backs to ribbons before the rising of the moon. He is not clever like his brothers. His speech is notably less refined, but for all this, the Prophet dotes on him, cherishes him, perhaps more than all the rest. Consequently, there is no more dangerous man in the camp.
Chindelin gestures at the knife.
That's his Madeline you wanted to touch.
Devil shit! You said it was the Prophet's.
She's making a present of it to the thirdborn. He wants to use it in war, can you believe it? That thing belongs in a museum, or mounted on some Sartaf's wall, and not just because it's priceless. There's a history behind that knife, I gather. Dark sins and curses. Rubbish, if you ask me, but Ojulon believes it will make him a hero on the battlefield. Take the sausage, Condry.
The meat is so delicious it hurts. For a few precious moments, Condry cannot think of knives, pushers, Ojulon, Mektu's terrible rumor. Chindelin laughs and pokes him in the chest.
You mention these to anybody, it's your ass.
He had a whole wagon load of dainties. Wine, brandy, licorice, seed cakes, honey cakes, hams.
Straight from the valley. He gave me these with a big smile. It's true what they say about his teeth.
Gold?
Solid gold. Six or eight of them, anyway.
Check as hell, but that smile gave me the creeps.
Condry gestures at the Madoglin. It won't be damaged. Ojulon never goes anywhere near the fighting.
Chindelin's smile fades.
He's going north with the Third Legion.
Condry is speechless. North is the largest, hottest front, where the Vajeks resist them still.
The depraved and bloody Vajeks.
That is the phrase all children learn. Merciless occupiers before the Prophet drove them out. Lunatics, liars, believers in a single god.
Why now? Says Condry.
Chindelin leans close.
Ojulon had to have the knife, he murmurs. They say he was squirming, begging, that he promised to become a war hero if only Mommy gave him this toy.
His uncle's disrespect chills Condry's blood. What has gotten into everyone? To call her Radiance, that. Even to whisper such words in confidence, even to think them. He puts the rest of the sausage in his mouth and chews. The meat seems almost flavorless now. He wipes his hand on his trousers.
Mektu says we're going to attack the Galsune. Just our legion, just the Eighth.
He's right, says Chindelin. There was talk of it this morning. In a day or two, everyone will know.
The chill deepens. Are they hurt somehow, the Galsune? He asks. Chindelin shrugs. Maybe their crops failed, or they've suffered some disease?
I couldn't tell you, boy.
Because otherwise it's madness, says Condry. The Eighth Legion's too small. You know what happened last time.
The smith rubs his face. All at once, he is reluctant to look Condry in the eye.
Not as well as you do, he says.
Just past midnight, a team of soldiers comes for the knife. They are led by Ojulon's deputy, a ferocious officer named Idaru. A colonel and a terror in his own right, Idaru stands 6'10". On his cheeks are the ritual burns of the Messerat clan, spirals that look as if they were made with heated wire. He storms up to Condry and screams in his face, "What in Jekka's hell are you doing here? Who are you to gaze at the Prophet's gift to Lord Ojulon? Were you planning to steal it, you dog?"
Condry's uncle lifts his hands.
"I asked him to be here, Colonel. I didn't know what was happening. Lord Ojulon told me he'd be back within the hour."
"Lord Ojulon is," Idaru stammers, "busy, detained. Lord Ojulon has 1,000 cares."
"Yes, sir.
And I knew Corporal Hingeman would fight to protect his property, just as I would. He's like a son to me, sir."
The colonel's nostrils flare.
"That is good, then. That is excellent. Why did you not speak up for yourself, Hingeman? The Prophet requires boldness of her men."
Condry promises, with great contrition, to be bold.
"See that you are."
Idaru's eyes shift to Chindelin.
"Your man here could be out drinking and fornicating, Smith. But instead he is here with you, guarding the Thirdborn's property." "I am pleased with you, Hingeman."
"Thank you, Colonel," says Condry.
"Your breath is somewhat foul, however. Do you brush your teeth?"
"Twice daily, sir."
"Show me."
Condry opens wide. Before he knows what is happening, the colonel's hand is in his mouth.
"Close gently. That's right."
The colonel withdraws his hand. Condry stiffens. Idaru has placed an object in the pouch of his cheek, and his men, all of them, have aimed their spears in his direction.
"Speak through your teeth," says the colonel. "Don't move your jaw until I say so. Your life depends on your obedience."
Sweat breaks out all over Condry's body. The thing in his mouth is light and brittle, like a hollow egg. A hint of sugar teases his tongue.
"Colonel, what in Ong's name?"
Chindelin starts forward, but Idaru's look stops him cold.
"Keep still," he says. "This is no punishment. Corporal Hingeman is among the first to be honored with this chance to prove his loyalty.
and to place a new tool in the arsenal of the Prophet. We hope to use this test often in the future, if all goes well.
The new test, Condry thinks. It's real. Ong All-Merciful, I'm going to die.
There is an insect in your mouth, says the colonel. Or more precisely, a chrysalis. The vermin itself is dormant, but the warmth of your blood will change that.
Any moment now. Condry gives a distorted cry. Something has twitched inside the shell.
Do not touch your cheek, snaps Idaru. Stop that shaking at once.
I'm loyal, Condry pleads through locked teeth. I love the Prophet. Her feet walk heavens.
The insect is an ash locust, says the colonel. It has neither bite nor sting. But the fluid inside the chrysalis is a contact poison. Should it touch your flesh, you will be paralyzed. First your facial muscles, then your throat, eventually your lungs and heart.
Condry starts to plead again, but the colonel silences him with a gesture.
If you are loyal, you have nothing to fear. The chrysalis alone is almost too fragile to touch, but we have glazed it with another substance. A rather extraordinary substance. A sugar that dissolves more quickly in a liar's mouth than that of an honest man. Do you follow?
Speak falsely, and the shell will rupture before I finish my questions. Speak the truth and live. Condry stares at the colonel, rigid with horror. He can distinctly taste the sugar now. His uncle's chest is heaving, his big hands forming fists.
Condry Hingeman, says Idaru. Are you a loving servant of Her Radiance, the Prophet?
A nod will suffice.
Suffice to kill me?
He cannot help the thought. He dares not hesitate. He nods. The locust twitches, and so does Condry. Every part of him, save his face.
And are you a willing soldier in this war? Asks Idaru.
Sweetness coats Condry's tongue, but in his mind a strange cold has descended. Is he willing? Is any part of him still true? He nods. The locust is squirming violently now. The shell quivers and jumps.
Colonel Idaru, pleads Chindelin. This is a flawless soldier you're experimenting on. He nearly met his death in the Galsune campaign. He had an audience with the Prophet herself. He's one of us. I'll stake my life on that.
The colonel turns to Chindelin with deliberate slowness.
If you value him so, why delay me with these outbursts? You may doom an innocent man.
If he's innocent. Another extravagant pause. At last, his gaze returns to Condry.
One more question, he says. Is there any person in this camp, anyone at all, whose loyalty you doubt?
Condry closes his eyes, and in the darkness, Mektu's face appears like a sallow bloom. His crooked grin, his provocations, his hopeless dreams of escape. The insect writhes, the shell bulges. He shakes his head.
Spit it out! Snaps the colonel.
Condry doubles over. The chrysalis drops from his mouth, slick and translucent. Even as it strikes the dirt, it ruptures, and a barbed black leg twitches free. Then it's gone, crushed by the colonel's boot. Idaru sets a hand on Condry's arm.
Rejoice, he says. This, too, is part of winning the war. You have both faith and courage, and from this moment no one may question them. Our Prophet shall hear of your strength today, Corporal Hingeman. That's a promise.
He is seated in the dust, knees raised, head thrown back against the wall. Chindelin is cleaning his tools, hands shaking. He has yet to breathe a word. Idaru and his men have departed with the golden blade. The test failed. Condry dares not say it, even to Chindelin. But in his mind there is no doubt. Perhaps, in some wildly unlikely way, he was truthful in his first two answers. But not the third. Mektu is no more a loyal soldier than he is a lamb chop. Condry has just lied for him. By rights, he should be dead. Condry looks at the flattened insect. A new tool in the arsenal of the prophet. A useless tool, apparently. How many times has it been tested? Has it killed true believers just because their nerves betrayed them? Or did something more than blind luck save Condry's life? Uncle, he says, my brother wants to bug out. Chindelin leans hard on his workbench.
He said the same to me this afternoon. I kicked him right out of the shop. You can't fucking run, I told him. You can bitch, drink, use wax, chew gumroot. You can fight and whore around with village girls, but not run. A man who runs is a man who stopped believing, and that can't be overlooked. Now go and straighten out your head.
He didn't listen, did he? The smith turns, his upper lip curled in anger.
Do you know what he was doing the whole time I spoke? He was staring up at the mountain. And when I finished, he said, with a fast horse, I could be there before anyone missed me. In 2 days, I'd be home.
Condry shuts his eyes. Mektu would never make it home, and if he did, he could only bring death to their family and friends. The Satapre Valley is still beautiful, still green, but its rulers serve the prophet now, and every street has its spy.
That's what he meant when he asked if I was with him, says Condry. Gods, what can you do with such a fool?
He locks eyes with Chindelin, and there is a wariness between them, sudden and immense.
Because, you know, even if someone thought they had a chance...
Not that way, says Chindelin.
Not that way, exactly. Any idiot could come up with a better plan. I don't mean better, I mean smarter. A more cunning plan.
As a pastime. As a game in the head.
The smartest way to run off. I mean, for a traitor to run off. We're just thinking, for the sake of a game.
No crime in that, says the smith.
They cast nervous glances at the doorway. Condry can feel his own face, his false smile, like something carved out of wood.
You'd have to run east, I suppose.
Chindelin nods, looking strange and miserable.
Straight east, he says, like firewalkers running through coals. Across the wind plain, down the cliffs, through the wastes of the stolen sea, if that's even possible. And then gods help you, because, think about it now, where could you be aiming for, ultimately? The desert, Condry? The Samuradath Jal?
You'd have to be crazy, says Condry.
Samuradath Jal, the land that eats men.
And what about your eyes? Asks Chindelin. The whole world knows what the prophet pays for deserters. What's the first thing a bounty hunter looks at?
The eyes, uncle, I know.
New soldiers in the Army of Revelation are taken to a darkened hut where the extract of a certain cactus is dribbled into their eyes. The pain is terrible, but fades within hours. What never fades is a slight purple staining of the eyeball. The stain is invisible beyond a yard or two, but up close it is unmistakable. Every last soldier bears the mark. Chindelin shakes his head.
Bounty men, bandits, slavers, they'd pounce on a deserter like cats on cream.
You'd have to run far, says Condry. Impossibly far. South of the Blue Mountains, maybe, or Kasralis City, where the desert ends. Is Kasralis as magnificent as they claim, uncle?
Chindelin shrugs.
It's a wonder of the world, boy. Everyone knows that.
Condry's voice quickens. Our captain says that before the quarantine, people crossed the ocean just to see Kasralis, which means there's nothing like it anywhere, not even in the outer world. He jumps. Chindelin is scowling, as though visited by a dreadful thought.
Uncle, says Condry,
you know I wasn't really... Shut the fuck up, of course.
Their mouths close like drop gates. They watch the bats fly in circles. A lamp abruptly winks out.
Mektu saved my life,
says Condry. At the end of the first Galsune campaign. We were fleeing. The bastards had chased us to the river. Someone cracked my skull with a stone.
I heard all about it, says the smith. Not from Mektu. He never boasted about that day. It was that friend of his, old Flappy Years.
Batali.
Right,
says Chindelin.
He said that when you fell, the others left you for dead. That they were trampling you.
I can't remember a thing after the stone, says Condry.
Mektu carried you for 5 hours on his back. They tried to make him abandon you. One man even seized your arm and tugged. I guess he thought that if Mektu dropped you, he'd never have the strength to pick you up again. Mek didn't drop you, but he did lay you flat. Then he turned to the man who had grabbed you and beat him until the man curled up, begging for mercy through his broken teeth. Mek lifted you up again and carried you another 4 miles to the field camp.
He did that? For me?
The blacksmith nods. You had better learn to talk to him, Condry. Now give me a hand.
They lower the chains, extinguish the oil lamps one by one. When the last flame dies, only the glow from the furnace remains. They stand before its scarlet maw, warming themselves, two shadows reluctant to fade into the night.
I promised the old man I'd protect you both, says Chindelin. I swore it the day you enlisted. But there's nothing else I can do for your brother. I've tried, Condry. I've tried more than you know.
Never mind, says Condry. I'll make him listen, or I'll break his legs. The crazy fuck. He shouldn't be here at all. Chindelin looks up sharply. In his eyes, further treason, another glance at the abyss. None of us should be here, says the look. The half-brothers were born 3 days apart. For over a decade, neither suspected the other's existence. Condry lived in a ramshackle house on Candle Mountain, in the coastal range, with his mother and a blind cook, and a stream of orphans delivered without comment by the old man. Condry could not see the ocean, but late afternoons he could see the sunlight glancing off the ponds, streams, and fish tanks of the Satapre Valley. Turning east, he looked up at Green Pass. That name was a stale joke. Nothing was green at those altitudes save the lichen and the mold on the flatbread. The house wheezed and shifted in the constant winds. In plain truth, it had once been a horse barn and was still divided into stalls. For years, Condry slept under the words speckled hen, painted in a ghostly blue above his bed. He supposed it referred to a particularly favored horse. Condry's mother, Uthe, kept goats rather than horses. She made goat cheese for the mountain farmers and sold their wool in fine black bolts and worked their dung into the stony soil. Condry held her in awe. She wove snares for grouse and partridges. She fried goat intestines with salt and chilies. She coaxed beans and root vegetables from their fragile garden, and somehow, even in the dead of winter, the food never quite ran out. But she drew the line at the orphans.
Not one night, she told Condry's father. You bring them with coin enough to pay for their food, or don't bring them at all.
Lantor Hingeman grinned and shrugged his shoulders, but he never crossed Uthe in the matter. The orphans came from the east, from the desert or its margins. There was fighting in those lands, and also something that drew his father, who crossed the pass several times a year. Condry dreamed of these visits. His father was no good, of course. All the mountain folk concurred in this. But when he stomped into the yard and sought them out with his gaze, something kindled in Condry's heart, and his breath came easier for a time. In his earliest memories, his father brings gifts. If he had come from the Satapre, it was fruit and sweets, and occasionally astonishing toys he built himself. These creations were the pinnacle of wonder in Condry's first years, and left him in no doubt that his father was a magician. There was a delicate spider, bone, wire, bristle-covered feet, that could scurry across a floor and, meeting a wall, ascend it all the way to the ceiling. There was an iron dragon with a water reservoir in its chest and a space for live coals in its belly.
It whistled, blew clouds of steam from its nostrils, opened its jaws, and spat sparks. Most beloved of all was a gleaming, articulated copper snake.
"A sidewinder," said the old man,
"that slithered with a strange, hypnotic pattern when set on the hot stone of the winter hearth, and wound itself into a perfect coil as if going to sleep as it cooled."
"Our secret,"
his father would proclaim with a hard but happy glance before presenting one of these marvels.
"Never a word about these to anyone, save your mother and the orphans. You understand? And never outside the house. And hide them all away if a visitor should call."
Condry promised, but disaster struck all the same. In his sixth year, on Midsummer's Day, he yielded to the temptation to see if the patio stones, throbbing with heat, might bring his snake to life in the same manner as the hearthstone. The question was answered in a matter of seconds. The snake took off across the patio, a wriggle of copper lightning. Condry laughed and gave chase, and then the old tomcat that roamed the fields appeared out of nowhere, pounced on the snake, and vanished with it into the sloughberry thicket behind the house. Uthe Hingeman turned pale when Condry admitted what he had done. The wild sloughberries ranged over 6 acres, giving way eventually to brambles and gorse. Condry's mother slashed her way through the thicket for days in search of the toy, and not, Condry knew somehow, out of any concern for his loss. When Lantor Hingeman paid a visit a fortnight later, she made Condry stand before him and confess. The old man stood frozen for a few seconds, then turned and left the property. An hour later, he was back with a neighbor's ox and plow. He spent the next day cutting a wide furrow around the sloughberries. When nothing flammable remained in the furrow, he set the berries on fire and burned the whole 6 acres to ash. He never told Condry whether or not he had found the snake. He never grew angry or spoke a word of reprimand. But that night he searched out every wondrous toy in the household and took them away when he departed, and never brought such things again. With the years, Condry began almost to wonder if those little miracles had been a dream. Had the dragon really belched fire? Had the spider truly climbed? It grew hard to insist on the reality of these toys when no one would speak of them, or even confirm that they had existed. His mother grew silent and troubled. She and Lantor Hingeman talked less and less, but he still smiled his wolfish smile for Condry, and he still, after a fashion, came with gifts. Weird artifacts of his travels, square coins, shark's teeth, lizard eggs turned to stone, and once the blind cook, and often, as the war crept nearer, orphans. But the orphans never stayed. After a month or two, strangers would appear in the evening, share a quiet tea with Condry's mother, and lead the children off by the dry mountain trails. Condry wept at these partings, even though it meant more food for the rest of them. Never once did these frightened, stick-thin waifs show the least disrespect to him or his mother, or even the cook. Some spent whole days in corners, staring at the nearest window or door. Others woke howling as though stabbed in their sleep. One girl fled the house without waking and was fetched home the next day by the dog. So, life. 14 years in this vein. Then came a day when Condry found his mother seated at the table, stone dead, her left hand swollen and purpled like some obscene fruit by the bite of a rare plumage viper. Chin on chest. The book she'd stolen a few minutes to read before the day's work began still open on the table, steam rising from her teacup. The viper, an undeniably beautiful coil of feathery, silver-white scales, lay in the iron cauldron near the fireplace, where it had apparently crawled for warmth. Condry walked to the adjacent farm, and the old couple there hired a messenger. The next day his father came from the valley with a shovel and a mule. He chose a spot with a view of the lowlands, and with his own hands he assaulted the stony ground. Condry watched, sick and stupid with grief, an orphan girl on either side of him clinging to his hands. Slowly, impossibly, His father cut a rectangle, a narrow wound in the earth. Condry bethought himself and asked to take a turn with the shovel.
Damned right you will,